This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. Today, I get to speak with Dr. Caleb Simmons from the University of Arizona on a fantastic new 2020 OUP publication, Devotional Sovereignty. Hello, Caleb.
Hi, Rod. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I think we were chatting earlier that this isn't your first time on the program. You were on in 2018. In your role as co-editor of a collected volume, The Nine Nights of the Goddess. But now we get to talk about your monograph.
Yeah, I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And our paths have crossed before, it seems. I contributed to that project, the Nine Nights project, but I think we actually met at the AAR presentation of that project, probably close to 10 years ago by now. And what's interesting is I think the name in the AR program for that project was The Goddess and the King.
Exactly.
That name is also, I believe, the name of your dissertation.
That's
and
correct.
The name of the book that I wrote for my dissertation, my first book. And so we can empirically demonstrate that our research our research is quite related, and because of that, I'm going to err on playing the part of the naive, hopefully not blithering idiot, but the naive interlocutor, so as to refamiliarize myself with some of the material you talk about. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
Great. So maybe just situate the listeners in terms of where and when. So geographically, historically, locate us for the purposes of your research.
Okay, great. Yeah. So the book, Devotional Sovereignty, it's focusing on the bridge between early modernity and modernity. So what I've called in the book, late early modern, early colonial. And so, of course, these dates are movable, but the firm dates, because I focus on two people, Tipu Sultan and Krishna Raja Whittier III, really I'm covering between 1782 and 1868, with 1782 being the year that Tipu Sultan was installed as the Sultan of the Mysore Sultanate, and 1868 when his successor, Krishna Raja Whittier III, dies. But of course, this is some looking at it as a bridge period. I'm also interested in how they're using sources from before this period on into the pre-modernity, and then rethinking them, re-envisioning them in ways that really shape the rest of the colonial period and on into even modern democratic India by formulating what it means to be sovereign in India through this period. And so that's the time frame. And I'm specifically looking at the former kingdom of Mysore, which is situated in southern India, just to the south of the Deccan Plateau. So that's below it's just south of where all the large medieval empires of Karnataka were. So you have like the Bahmanis, the Adil Shahis, Vijayanagara. So they're just to the south of that, situated between the Western Ghats and the Tamil-speaking zone. So this gives an interesting geographical space because they're close in proximity to these large empires that arise in Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, yet they remain somewhat isolated because they're inland, they're protected on their west by the Ghats. And so it actually, a lot of aspects of the colonial encounter are pretty slow getting into Mysore because they're landlocked. They had a reputation for being fierce warriors and often called barbarians within European sources. So a lot of the processes of colonialization don't really come into the area until much later, which gives us an abundance of resources to see how the negotiations of kingship, of sovereignty, how all of these take place in this period of Tipu Sultan and Krishna Raja Woodyer III to formulate what it means to be an Indian king during a period of European and British military battles on into the losses that are incurred and eventually into being a British subject. So it provides us an interesting insight to some of the things that happen in other places throughout India, now with just a larger archive to see how these things unfolded.
So we have a great sense of the where and the when. Tell us about the what and the how. What are you after? What are you asking? What is your research hoping to demonstrate or elucidate? And also, how do you go about doing so? What types of sources do you rely upon?
Yeah, that's a great question. So since you brought up our shared titles, this project actually started with my dissertation, The Goddess and the King, because I guess you would notice from being on this channel on New Books Network is that my focus is Hindu studies. So I was started off actually looking at the goddess Chamundeshwari in Mysore. And as I learned more about her and more about the history, I started to shift to think more about the relationship between the goddess and the king in Mysore. So in my dissertation, I was interested in reading genealogies about the goddess, about the Woodyer kings, in which they talk about the goddess and their goddess patronage. And from this, I started getting more interested in what the function of these genealogies were. And from a dissertation that started really in the 14th century and went all the way through 1868 also, I started thinking more deeply about the function that they played. And then I had an extremely formative conversation with the Maharaja of Mysore only a few weeks before he passed away in 2013. And this led from the changes from a broad dissertation about the goddess and the king to something more focused on sovereignty, because the conversation didn't exactly go the way I thought, which is actually the way I decided to start this this book. As I went and met with them and was very excited to demonstrate my knowledge of Kannada literature, especially that produced within the court of Mysore. And not only was he not impressed, but actually started to send me to sources and said, it is a really formative comment. And he said, if you really want to know about Indian kingship, you should go read James Todd's book about Rajasthan, because Rajputs are the true kings of Mysore. And if you want to know about paintings, don't look at this local stuff here. Look at Raja Ravi Varma, the famous painter of sort of a neoclassical style. And I was shocked. And I sort of walked away from that deflated thinking, why doesn't he like his whole kingdom? And then the more I thought about it, I was like, you know what? I completely missed the point. The point wasn't that he didn't like his court didn't believe in the productions from it, because actually we had an extremely fruitful conversation. He was very well informed and about the history of the literature from the court and the different texts. But what had happened was he had consciously thought about identity and was framing himself in a different way than the way I wanted to frame the Whittier Kings. And so he was carefully curating different sources, different histories that he had to articulate his identity, because part of the identity of the Whittier Kings now is claiming this ancestry to the Rajputs and to North India. And then also sort of demonstrating that the Mysore King himself included, and probably foremost, was sort of a international cosmopolitan king. So what he wasn't disparaging the histories of his court, but he was just shaping where what his kingship was, articulating his own identity in a different way than what I wanted him to. And as part of this process, I'd asked him for access to his library of these texts, and I was denied. And what I realized again upon reflection was that this actually was him demarcating his sovereignty, that he had the ability to grant or deny my request. And so he exercised his sovereignty to say, no, you could not have access to them. You have to go find them elsewhere. So as I reflected more and more on this conversation, I thought about the material from Tipu Sultan and Krishna Raja Whittier III, and thought, you know, this is a similar process that it was taking place during their kingship, that the boundaries, the domains of their sovereignty were in flux and they were being contested. And so the articulations coming from the court, whether they're literature, genealogies, material culture, paintings, all of those work to construct a royal identity. And through these, they were also helping to demarcate the boundaries of their sovereignty, either by talking about conquest, as Tipu Sultan did in early on within his courtly literature, or the courtly literature of his courtiers, or moving forward in time to Krishna Raja Whittier III. By the end of his reign, he's really demarcating his sovereignty over Hindu identity and patronage of Hindu temples. So that's really how the entire project developed to get me to my new question of, you know, what does it mean to be a sovereign, particularly an Indian king, in a period to where you don't have military or administrative control? Do you stop being king, or do you simply become king in a new way? And so this is what I saw with the late Maharaja, but also within Tipu Sultan and Krishna Raja Whittier III.
In terms of period pieces, which question what it means to be sovereign? I quipped earlier before we began that Netflix needs to make an Indian Crown series set in this line of kings in Mysore. My bias notwithstanding, I find both the research and the trajectory and the fact that your quest to understand kingship, Indian kingship, was literally directly impacted by a living Indian king, I find that endlessly fascinating. Fortuitous, fated, serendipitous, certainly atypical, to say the least, especially for a textualist like yourself, someone looking to archives. So what was he signaling to you? What was he, the answer you got from the Maharaja, like, what do you think his motivation was to direct you to those sources, especially as pertains to your research project?
Yeah, this actually gets me to part of the big question about the historical material that I look at too. Is, you know, when I read a lot of things, particularly from the 80s, 90s, and some into the earlier 2000s, a lot of people talk about, you know, the legitimization of kingship, and talk about it as sort of a what strikes me is like almost they're, you know, sitting in their throne rooms with their courtiers conniving about how to do this. And I think it's a more organic process that happens as people get together and think about who they are or who their kings are and what they want to present to the world. I mean, we're always involved in self-fashioning now, trying to reflect on ourselves. So I don't necessarily think that the Maharaja was trying to steer me one way or the other, but I think that his own personal identity was so wrapped into these ideas of Rajput identity, also forward into thinking about himself as an international cosmopolitan man, that when I presented him what I thought kingship was and ought to be for Mysore, it was only natural for him to articulate his understanding of his royal identity. And so I think that this is also what's happening in these late, early modern, early colonial courts, is that, you know, they're searching for where their boundaries are. They're not necessarily conniving what they are, if that makes any sense, that they're actually like, they're finding their spots of sovereignty and then enacting and articulating the new identity that comes along with it. So it's an organic process that comes about. And we really see this in Tipu Sultan. So Tipu Sultan is a striking historical figure because really, if you go on Twitter, go on Instagram and search hashtag Tipu Sultan, you get a wide range of responses. Oftentimes, the most numerous of the posts will be coming from India, which will call him, bloodthirsty, Muslim terrorist, a zealot. And then you also will find maybe what you might call a minority opinion in India, which is that he was a great freedom fighter. And then for Pakistan, he remains a great freedom fighter for all of India. So he has this, personality and this history that still evokes a lot of interest from people. But what we find over his actual career is that he is by far not some sort of monolithic character. He starts off as king in 1782, very much positioning himself as his father, who had been hired as a mercenary by the Woodiers and eventually became appointed as the king of the Keledi region up in Bednuru, positions himself as both the king of Bednuru and the sultan of Mysore, framing himself as divinely elected to become king because, one, he was the most militarily capable. In fact, shortly after his installation, he's able to defeat the British, which, from my understanding, he is the first of any Indian king to be completely able to beat the British and force them into a treaty in which they have to retreat and give up land. And so at this point, it's all about like his military identity, that he's the best. It's all based on divine election through proof of conquest, but also framing himself as a proper genealogy of a king coming from the Arabian Peninsula, perhaps even a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, depends on which genealogy you're reading. But of course, this is when he was the victor. After he loses the third Anglo-Mysore War in 1792, and then moving forward as his position is weakening, he shifts away from this and starts focusing more on divine election through the grace of God, through the authority of gurus and of Sufi saints. So you see that he's not monolithic in many ways, but particularly not in the way that he's articulating his own sovereign identity through the ways that he was divinely elected to become that king.
So just to alert the reader, the listener, these two rulers are adjacent. The Sultan reigned from 1782 to 1799, I believe, and then was immediately followed by Krishnaraja Wodeyar III. So they make for a fascinating juxtaposition. And the book is actually organized such that the first three chapters are dedicated to the Sultan, and the following four are dedicated to Krishnaraja Wodeyar. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, so this is, I mean, thanks to one of my readers, the infamous reader number two, who actually came up with a lot of brilliant suggestions. Previously, when looking at the book, you might notice that the two parts are sort of parallel, that the first chapter on Tipu Sultan looks at genealogy. The first one for Krishna Raja Woody are also on genealogy. The second about sort of displays of devotion to certain sites that were important in pre-modernity. So in both of them. And the third is about sort of material and visual cultures and how these articulate sovereignty. So these used to be actually just huge, massive chapters that was on like genealogy, one on like patronage, and then one on visual art. So it was a, you know, the same length of a book, just with three massive chapters. So luckily I was able to split them into two parts, which works much better for the reader. So I encourage everyone not to be so down on reader number twos, because they have some good suggestions. But yeah, so they follow this the same sort of trajectory. And this is what kind of makes them so interesting to look at together, is that, you know, in their popular characterization, and sadly in their historical characterization also, people view them as polar opposites. One strong military, whichever, you know, way you want to take that, and then, you know, sort of puppet monarch. And I don't believe either of them are just those things. In fact, Krishna Raja Woodier, I see him far from being a puppet, but actually someone who strongly resists British rule. So as you said, Tipu Sultan dies in 1799. He's killed at the Battle of Srirangpatna by the British. And this caused a moment of turmoil within the colonial body. This is, at this point, the British East India Company, because they knew that they needed, because this is still when they had their whole sort of non-interference policy, that they needed to reinstall a king. But they feared if they reinstalled Tipu Sultan's children, that eventually they would just eventually rise up against the British, and they would have to go through another series of Anglo-Mysore wars. So instead, they install Krishna Raja Woodier III. And this is where the story gets tied into British historiography as well, because when they install him, and in fact, if you go back and look at the records, there's a lot of hand-wringing about who they should install, and a lot of discussions of what we could call political theology, in which, you know, they're saying, well, Tipu Sultan's kids have the right to be the king, because Tipu Sultan has the right of conquest because he defeated the Woodier kings. And then other people saying, well, you know, he actually was a usurper and the Woodier kings are the rightful rulers. Eventually, they decide on the what they call the reinstallation or the restoration of the Woodier lineage. And in each case, they always frame this. And so they had a, you know, is what you might call early colonial PR department that was really good at spin. And so they framed it as the restoration of the ancient Hindu family, which by ancient, it's a little unknown exactly when the Woodier lineage started, but probably it's in the 16th century. So it's a very young dynasty to be calling the restoration of the ancient Hindu family. But this sets a trajectory for how Krishna Raja Woodier III will articulate his sovereignty as a proper Hindu ruler coming from a proper Hindu lineage. And he's trained by trained and educated by the British. So whenever there's things being produced out of the court of Mysore during his period, he's producing things that make sense within that British historiography. So the Vamshavalis, or the lineage texts that are created during this period, they're not like those of Tipu Sultan or any of their predecessors, which began with sort of in the mode of the Puranas, or at least texts that are trying to be Mahapuranas with the Panchalakshana, because they don't have, you know, the creation of the universe, the cycles with recreation, going through the ages of the Manus, or any of these things. It just starts with Mahavishnu and gives a genealogy that actually reads a lot like, if you're familiar with the genealogies of the Hebrew Bible, or especially in some of the Gospels of the Christian Bible. And if you go back and trace it, the number of lineages with it, which I do in the book, the number of lineages in the lineage text from Krishna Raja Woodier III map onto the age of the world within the Christian context of the British, to where, you know, it's just a few thousand years old, and you can trace all Christian Roger Whittier all the way back to Mahavishnu, who gave birth to Brahma from his navel. So, yeah, getting back to the point, these are two kings that are really different at first glance, but actually when you look more deeply, they're quite parallel in how they're navigating the worlds of their identity.
You've actually, first of all, endlessly fascinating to have for me anyhow, to have a Puranic account of a line of kings that parallels sort of the Abrahamic timeline since creation. It's so good. So you preempted actually my next question, which was, you know, the book is organized the way it is by these leaders. Obviously, there's lots of different data in each of the chapters, each of the respective chapters, but it seems to be drawing parallels more than contrasts between the two men, would you say?
Yeah, because, I mean, both of them are heavily interested. When I say both of them, I mean the kings and their courts, because I don't think that, even though they're both attributed to writing a lot of texts, or a lot of texts are attributed to them, this is not one person working in isolation. It's clear that there is a vast knowledge of history here that seems like you would need a team of people developing these and being commissioned and all of this, the work that would go into creating extensive catalogs of visual, literary, material culture. So you would need artisans, poets, painters, dancers and performers. I don't really get into that in the book, but there's also, you know, yakshaganas being written at this point. There's songs and hymns. So there's a lot of other things that aren't included in the book that could have been. I actually forgot the question.
Oh, it's always about the scenic route. It's great either way, but I was sort of driving at the extent to which, despite the very different data for each of these kings, there are these parallel themes that are core to your argument.
Right. Yeah. So thank you for reminding me. got off my own little tangent. Yeah. So no, they are to me so similar. And part of the similarities between these two kings is that we, looking back on them, want to force them into all the history that has taken place since they lived. So when we look at this through the, you know, for the British historiography, we look at this through partition, we look at this through conflicts between Pakistan and India, but those things didn't exist for them, at least in my opinion, because I don't think either of them think of their religious identity as that's something that divides them from other people. So like Tipu Sultan, of course he was a Muslim. This is not to be debated. I don't think that he's ever wasn't a Muslim, and it's not my place to judge who's a good and bad Muslim, but he saw himself first and foremost as an Indian king. And so he writes constantly, and these are actually in his own journals and letters that he writes to people, that he puts the protection of Hindustan above anything else. And so he'll make treaties with Muslims, but also with Hindu Rajputs up in Rajasthan. He'll patronize gurus up in Sringeri, the Jagat Guru of Sringeri. He will ally himself with the French and even create a Jacobin club in Mysore. So he does a lot of things that, if you're trying to think about like Muslim identity from today's perspective, you might think that this would go against tenets. But for him, that wasn't his number one priority. His number one priority was to be a good ruler. So I think this is important for Tipu Sultan. He goes about it in one particular way, but so does Krishna Raja Whittier. He leans more heavily into the identity of being a Hindu, so because that's sort of what was the time period he was living in. But he also thinks more broadly about
you know, he is an Indian king, and he's wanting to restore what Indian kingship should be, which is a free, independent sovereign, not just of Mysore, but he looks around to all of India. And the seventh chapter that I have actually looks at how he constructs sort of a model for independent India by sending one of his subordinates, a local priest, around to different kingdoms throughout India, taking icons, insignia from them, but also visiting the temples that are important nearby, and thinking of Hindu identity as something that's not isolated to one kingdom, as might have been, you know, in pre-modernity. But now all Indian kings are actually working together for Indian sovereignty against the British. So in those ways, these two kings, like, even though they're in some ways very different, they're actually doing the same exact thing.
The same exact thing in terms of crafting kingship, in terms of establishing the identification of the sovereign.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to think about, you know, what the role of an Indian king is, because both of them are primarily interested in the idea of the kingship of India, whether they call it, you know, Bharata or Hindustan. But that is the sort of locus of their focus, with both of them framing Mysore kingship as the epitome, the pinnacle, the apex of what it means to be an Indian king. So again, doing these same things that we see in inscriptions in medieval India, to where, you know, something like Daud Ali, and then all these people have talked about, to where you do rituals, you recreate your world as the center of the universe, and draw upon Puranic tropes and medieval rituals to sort of display that and articulate it.
It seems to me the work of modern day PR departments and establishing profiles, for example, online, this work is it's ancient. This is the work, as important as it is for an individual to establish an identity and project a persona into the world, how much more important is it for someone whose identity and persona the entire population depends upon? So it's really, really interesting. And I think there are a lot of fascinating broad questions that your research touches on. Why is your book called Devotional Sovereignty?
Yeah, great question. So it's because what I found in both cases, and I guess this gets to the previous question that you asked, is what exactly are they doing the same? Both of them, at some position, time in their kingship, for Tipu Sultan, it really begins in 1792, for Krishna Raja Whittier in 1831. They're in a position to where it seems like they recognize that they have lost something with their sovereignty. With Tipu Sultan, he had lost the Third Anglo-Mysore War to the British, and the British had taken his sons as ransom for the war debts. And at this point, I think that sort of hit home that maybe he's not the strongest military leader, or maybe that's not where he could cast his identity. So at this point, he shifts. And this is where a lot of the material has focused on him, where he labels his government the God-given government. He institutes a lot of Islamic reforms. As people said, like, oh, this is where he turns into a zealot, because he lost this. And that's looking, if you just look at certain materials, yes, I can see where people could misread the situation. But he continues doing things like patronizing Hindu temples. He has a long letter writing campaign or friendship with the Jagat Guru Sringeri. He engages with Hindu Rajputs, he engages with the French. So while part of the public creation of persona was for this Islamic reforms, a lot of this is also to get the attention of the Mughals, eventually when that doesn't work, the Afghani king, and then the Ottoman Empire. So there's also a strategy behind how he would rebrand his kingdom during this period. In 1831, Krishna Raja Whittier III loses administrative and financial control of the capital for what the British had called mismanagement of the resources. So these two moments become influential for how the kings start to create new articulations of their sovereignty. And both of them, what they do, getting to your question, is that they both turn heavily to devotion as how they're going to frame their kingship. For Tipu Sultan, it's about devotion to the Sringeri Guru, his devotion to Gisu Dharaz, who had been an important Sufi saint in the Deccan Plateau during the period of the Bahmanis, and framing them as his personal gurus from whom he derives his royal authority, that he is truly the elected of God, and proof comes through the authority that's passed on to him through these two important figures. So just to touch on that a little bit, Gisu Dharaz had been an imperial peer or Sufi saint for the Bahmanis, and then the Adil Shahs continue patronage to his dargah. So it's a way that Tipu Sultan is able to connect his own personal devotion back to the devotion of these larger kingdoms and empires before him. So he's building a genealogy of devotion at this point, as well as his previous genealogies of his own biology. Krishnaraja Whittier III also does this. And in fact, there's been previous studies like Janaki Nair's Mysore Modern, which is a brilliant book and one that really opened my eyes to a lot that goes on in Mysore. And a lot of my current interests are driven from reading that. But it seems in that book and in other studies that this moment of 1831 is when his patronage becomes lesser, or he just turns to religion because he doesn't have anything else to occupy his time. And what I actually found by actually made a spreadsheet of all of his donations, they actually skyrocket after 1831, just now from his personal resources. So he's no longer giving land grants because he doesn't have the authority to do that, but he's giving cash grants, giving jewelry, giving stones and precious metals. All of these start actually much more frequently after 1831. Also after this period, he begins a production of images of himself in devotion. So following a long tradition in South India of Bhakti Vigrahas, as they call them in Kannada, or these portraits of kings who are patrons in temples, he starts installing images of himself in temples and also those of his predecessors within temples. Yeah, he takes it one step further even and starts having lithographs made of himself worshiping different deities. And then these are then sent throughout the kingdom to different important families. And now when you go look at almost any museum that has collections from Mysore, one or two of these are painted lithographs of the king performing some sort of devotional ritual, some sort of puja. So what we find is in both cases, as the king lost certain modes of sovereignty, when they lost power over military or they lost administrative and financial control, where they turned was they turned to devotional practices. So they were starting to articulate their sovereignty as a new sort of sovereignty, at least what I see as emphasizing a new aspect of sovereignty, and that was their devotional sovereignty, their sovereignty over the devotional realm, be it through their patronage or their own personal devotion to Sufi saints, gurus, or deities in different temples.
Would you say both of these rulers were participating in what we might think of as the Indian idiom of bhakti?
Definitely. I mean, with Tipu Sultan, he's doing, of course, some different things that, you know, I'd let other people who are more well-versed with bhakti to Sufi saints or peers and discuss whether or not Bhakti's an appropriate term for that. But as far as his relationship with the Jagat Guru, definitely Bhakti is even a word that comes up in the letters that are within the Sringeri archive. And then when you get to Krishnaraja Whittier III, I mean, the term Bhakti Vigraha, the first time I ever saw it was actually in the large genealogical text that actually is attributed to him. He talks about the installation of these images and calls them bhakti vigrahas, or sculptures of bhakti, or sculptures that display bhakti. So very much for Krishna Raja Woodier, he sees himself as the perhaps the paradigm of Indian devotion. And where these images are installed are also, I think, helpful to seeing exactly how he viewed this. So in the temples that he installs images of himself, they are usually at the beginning or at the end of another series of images, whether it's one in a Vaishnava context in which he's there along with the famous Sri Vaishnava All Waters, or if he's in the in a Shaiva context with the Nayanars. So he's sees them, and which are both collections, either Vaishnava or Shaiva, of these very famous and important Tamil Bhakti poets. And so he puts himself right alongside of them. And not only is he right alongside them, but he's much larger. And so typically within Indian art, if something is larger, it is of more importance. And so by sort of putting himself in a sequence of all of these things, and as either the first or the last and the largest, you're going to see that he's creating a visual genealogy, a visual articulation of who he is, not just as a king, but who he is as a devotee, that he is an exemplary devotee. He's the best of all the devotees. And oh yeah, when you look at him, you also definitely recognize that he's a king, because he wears a turban, a tunic, he has a sword, his scepter. So there's no denying that he is a king. So for him, he is simultaneously the best king and the best devotee.
What is your core contention in terms of the crafting of kingship between these two men? In your book, I mean.
Yeah, as far as my core contention, can you explain what you're... I want to make sure I understand the question.
What is it... What is the central point you articulate in the book? What is it that you're driving at in terms of showing the ways in which these men... craft their sovereignty?
Right. So the primary argument, I mean, I guess I should frame it as my question and then my answer. So my question was, what does it mean to be king when you don't have all the things that we associate with royal power, when your sovereignty is limited? And so the answer for me, looking at Tipu Sultan and Krishna Raja Woodier III, when they were stripped of the things that they were associating with kingship, for Tipu Sultan, military power, for Krishna Raja Woodier III, administrative and fiscal authority, when those things were removed, they turned toward questions of, you call it religion, of metaphysics, of myths, all these different things that I would just say they're a turn to religious idioms. Particularly those in which they're shown as devotees. So they recast their sovereignty in light of devotion. So it becomes a devotional sovereignty at that moment. And so this is how they both seem to unfold. And I think that this is something that, other people have noticed in other contexts, and people that I talk about in the book during the intro, like Jan Osman talking about the covenant of Hebrews, or you get into Puranic studies with, one of the most influential articles that I've ever read was actually by Travis L. Smith, who talks about Skanda Purana and the Devodasa story, and about how it's, when you read the different versions, it's actually an articulation of contemporaneous debates, but by casting it in the world of the ancient. So the article's called Renewing the Ancient. It actually gives it this sense of longevity. This has always been the answer to this. I think both Tipu Sultan and Krishna Raja Woodier are, and their courts are masters at doing this, that when they sort of move into this new identity, them and their courts are able to make it seem like this is the way it's always been.
I think your point about Puranas is definitely resonant. The genre of Purana, very, very loosely, Indian mythology. Purana means ancient. And I think this part of the problem of Indological scholarship looking to the Puranas for an ancient past, I think the core of the issue there is that the Puranas are telling you that they're ancient because the contents in them are not. And I think it's always been the case of an avenue to legitimize through ancient lore what you're trying to establish in the present epoch. And I think that's sort of part of the core purpose of the Puranas. So in terms of your core argument, it sounds like would you say that these kings were perhaps looking to, they were supplanting their shaky secular authority with spiritual authority or religious authority?
Yeah, I think that it's, something that, again, I don't want to go as far as saying that it was something that was extremely contrived, but I think it might just be sort of the natural place that they went to. I mean, I could think about when I teach my undergrads and I talk about the life story of the Buddha or things like this. I always talk about, it's those moments to where we have suffering or turmoil is when a lot of people wind up turning to religion. And I think that this might be, a similar situation, and this is largely speculation, but when they're faced with turmoil, they turn to something that they see as stable and powerful and something that can help correct this. So I think that it's just sort of a natural movement to whenever, things don't go as planned within the earthly realm that people might turn to, or the physical realm, people might turn to like metaphysics to help them with their response. And so I think that it's sort of a natural movement that takes place, but one that then becomes sort of masterfully done to shape this new identity in a way that, again, I think is an organic one and one that has a lasting effect within India.
Yeah, it seems to me that irrespective of the extent to which these men may have been pious or devout or looking for grace, quote unquote, for their purposes, certainly there is the representation, the crafting, the presentation of sort of the inextricability between their rule, sovereignty itself, and sort of otherworldly forces. Like, it seems to me that it's a crucial move is this sort of marketing trope, perhaps even more so than just turning to the divine for their own personal aid.
Mm-hmm.
So you were thrown for a loop by you had the good fortune of gaining the audience of a Raja, and unlike currently, not a Raja in name alone, an actual Raja. And he threw you for a loop, and you went down this rabbit hole, and you he attuned you to probably a much more fascinating question, and you pursued it, and it seems, in my estimation, at least, you pursued it quite well, and produced something fascinating. What surprised you about this research? What was most surprising to you?
Most surprised me probably was how little work had been done on Mysore within the past, I don't know, we could say 20 years, and probably even extend that a little bit farther, because most people within Indological studies either know of Mysore or have been to Mysore because the Archaeological Survey of India Epigraphy Office is in Mysore, so a lot of people come through there. And a lot of people have sort of an idea of the general history of Mysore, at least as, these tropes of the model, a princely state, that they were one of the few kingdoms, I think it was three, that had a 21-gun salute. So they were extremely important. They have all these huge palaces, the goddess Chamundeshwari is there. So many people know of it and know about it, but so few people had studied it. Of course, the big exception being Janaki Nair's Mysore Modern, absolutely brilliant book. But even with her work, took different sources. And so a lot of the royal sources of Mysore prior to 1868 are just very understudied. So most of them are, you know, still only in epigraphy collections or in, I should say this is English studies, because there's a lot of them in Kannada. And a lot of the texts that were written during the medieval, early modern, early colonial period, you know, have actually been, you know, published as critical editions, especially from the University of Mysore. So people in Karnataka are working on it in Kannada. But as far as English studies, very few. So I was struck by this and just was kind of felt entirely fortunate the whole time that I had stumbled upon something that people seemed to be interested in and wanted to know a little bit more about, and somehow no one had done it. So I found that very, very interesting.
Absolutely. Do you plan on pursuing this data for subsequent work?
Hopefully. I've published different things about it, because I do find it so engaging to this point. So done a little bit of work on the late Maharaja of Mysore, thinking about some of these paintings also from the period of the book, thinking about them differently as cartography. So working sort of all around it, but eventually I would like to return to more of the work in my dissertation that looks at the previous kings, those before the Mysore Sultanate, before Tipu Sultan, which I think might be helpful for some people who read this book to think about all the continuities that I gesture toward, but actually seeing some of the a more thorough analysis and discussion of some of these tropes that are existing prior to Tipu Sultan within the Mysore court. And then, of course, right now I'm finishing up my second book, which is actually taking the opposite approach to some of the same issues. So looking at a folk song that talks about the history of Mysore and its creation, but from a folk position, which largely leaves out the kings. They make some cameos, but largely leaves it out. So hopefully that also will show that, people thinking about histories and curating the past are not just royal courts, but also sort of, maybe not everyday people, but people coming from a different perspective that is a less privileged perspective than the royal court.
So so we're sort of looking into a world that is removed from us geographically, culturally, historically, and you have sort of the royal peephole from this book that'll give you a glimpse into certain aspects of the royal court. And if I'm understanding you correctly, in the book you're working on now, we're again looking into the same time, space, cultural world, but from a different peephole, which doesn't show us the same vantage point or even the same objects as in the current book. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're so different, because I mean, both Tipu Sultan and Krishnaraja Whittier, especially in the first chapter on each, I'm really looking at the histories they're telling of themselves. And these are histories, I'm translating Vamshavali or lineage text. And so how they construct the history of Mysore, mainly based on kings, but also going back to mythological time or religiously important times, like for Tipu Sultan, it's more about the prophet Muhammad. For Krishnaraja Whittier III, it's about the creation of the world by Vishnu. And so the stuff that I'm working on now, they're interested in the same thing. So it's the history of Mysore, but instead of grounding it in, this is when X king came and established the kingdom, this was the beginning of Mysore, these texts actually ground it in the mythological battle between the goddess Chamundeshwari and the buffalo king Mahishasura. So the famous story of Durga killing the buffalo demon. And that becomes the story of the establishment of Mysore. The kings, of course, are brought into this very briefly, but it's actually all about Mysore as a place where the goddess came for her everyday devotees. This is for everyone. And so that's why Mysore is important.
So in terms of the goddess and the king, this book focuses on the king and the next one on the goddess, it seems.
Right, yeah. So I just separated the two out.
Right. Not to be mistaken with, for my book, The Goddess and the King, which right. talks only about the text, the textual world, and the interplay between the two. This has been, you know, as I say, I'm a little bit biased in terms of your specific subject area, but it's been quite fascinating talking about this book. Is there... were there any other aspects of the book or themes or data or anecdotes that come to mind that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Well, I would like to give one little plug to a different archive that I actually haven't discussed much, and that's the visual material from both Mysore courts from Tipu Sultan and Christian Raja Whittier III. I was very fortunate that my publisher, Oxford University Press, allowed me to have, I think it's 54 total images in the book. So there's a lot of reproductions of art produced in the Mysore court that I think most of them have been, this is the first time they're being published. I think it helps us to understand that these articulations are not just a textual thing, but you know, there is a material side to this with the creation of sculpture. There's the visual side with the creation of paintings and murals. And if you view any of these in isolation, at least at this period, you get one portion of what's going on. But really, you have to view them in their totality to be able to understand really what the court's trying to say. All of these fit into one big, you know, jigsaw puzzle that shows the full portrait of the king. You know, one example of this is with Tipu Sultan, something that I talk about in the third chapter. When people go to his summer palace in Srirangpatna, there are these beautiful murals all through it, especially around the outside, and everyone focuses on the images of war and the war processions, and rightly so. They're absolutely stunning. They give us military histories because we can see formations in it. You can see sort of the courtly culture through the processions of the different kings. So this is very interesting. And so most people sort of end their discussion of the murals at that point. But as you walk around to the other side, what you actually find is a very different portrayal of what kingship meant for Tipu Sultan, in which you find these sort of miniature palaces, all with portraits of his allies all throughout them. And so the one side we saw sort of war, battle, destruction, the pomp of the royal military procession. And then on these sides, you actually get a very peaceful, domesticated vision. So this, for me, became kind of like a symbol of what I'm trying to do, is that you have to see both parts. Is that for Tipu Sultan, it wasn't just about military conquest, but also that goes hand in hand with actually having peace and having allies and having prosperity within the kingdom. And of course, through this, you also have a bunch of different mosques displayed, or people at the mosque praying or reading the Quran. So of course, within that all, religion is the thread that helps tie all these together. And then when you step back from that and you try to think of it, you know, in its totality or the comprehensive statement, no longer is it just something about war, but really it's about being a king, that you have to go to war and you want to win. But then what happens as a result is that you can have peace. So I think that, you know, this happens in both courts, that you have these very multifaceted articulations of what sovereignty is, and you have to put them all in conversation with one another to really get the full picture.
I'm glad you made mention of the visual representations, because they enrich not only the reader's experience of the research, but they certainly enrich your argument. I mean, you're fortunate in that, you know, you found a peephole into this world that includes the purview of all of this material culture. It's fascinating and stimulating, to say the least. For those of you listening, we've been speaking today with Dr. Caleb Simmons from the University of Arizona on his 2020 OUP publication, Devotional Sovereignty. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Raj.
My pleasure as always. For those of you listening, stay safe, keep reading, keep thinking, and keep listening. Take care.